So this morning, as we continue our series on fixing up our families, on remodeling our families, I'm going to let you in on a little bit of the family dynamics in our home. So there are two things that kind of oftentimes shape some of the family dynamics in our home. And one is this, that I am a morning person and that Becca is not a morning person. That over the last 4 years, she has spent a lot of time in the middle of the night helping with kids, dealing with kids, doing things like that. And so she is not really much of an early morning person. But when I wake up kind of in that first moment, that's it for me. There isn't like a roll over, look at the time, and roll back over and fall asleep. Once my mind starts working, I'm awake. And so that's a difference that we have in our house. And there's another difference, and that's that I don't like to have an idle moment or an idle day. I don't like to have a time where there isn't something that we're doing, something that we're going, a project that we're working on. There are moments where I need those things. Oftentimes, I'll just keep doing something until I get sick, and I kind of have like a forced timeout. But I just don't like to get up in the day on a day off or otherwise and not have any plan for what that is going to look like. And so this often happens on days off. I will wake up in bed, and I will start laying there, and I will come up with all kinds of plans for the day. Plans that I would think of as being fun or spontaneous or, like something great for family time, whether that's a trip to go somewhere, whether that's like a hike or a bike ride, or, you know, oftentimes it involves an opportunity for me to drive past Little Amps or the Broad Street Market at lunchtime. There are all kinds of little things that I'll start sort of working in, and I'll start to craft this entire day of activities for us. And sometimes it might not be activities that are fun. It might be home projects, things that need to happen at the house, things that we kind of need to work on, things like that. And I'll get all of this kind of going on in my head. And then at the slightest hint of Becca showing a sign of life, her rolling over, her stretching, something like that, I'll spring the plan on her for the day. And I'll do it, I'll say, this is going to be great, this is exciting, this is good, I'll get the boys up, we'll start working on it, and then I'll feel deflated when there's less than an enthusiastic response that meets me at that. Or other times what will happen is I'll just kind of get out of bed altogether, and so I'll get up early, I'll take the boys, we'll go downstairs, and we'll start working on something for the day. Again, normally when I get up, I will make, a big mess, making a big breakfast, doing something like that, or starting some kind of a project, doing something like that, and then Becca will come downstairs, and it will kind of be, the day will have already started, and again, lots of times, I'll spring something on her. Well, I thought maybe I could just run to Home Depot for my biweekly trip, and we could do this, or there are lots of things that we can do, and so that happened. A memorable moment was last December, and I know that it was December 23rd, specifically. So, I got up that morning. The boys had been up, and so I decided I would let Becca sleep in the morning. I went downstairs, I got them breakfast, I got a cup of coffee, and I sat at the table, and we were talking a little bit. And then I decided, hey, let's remodel the bathroom, guys. And Becca and I had talked about this project of remodeling. It's a small powder room that's in our downstairs. We talked about it. We were kind of tentatively planning on doing it the week after Christmas. I had some vacation days I was using up, but it was, right before Christmas. And so so when Becca came down the steps, I was carrying the sink out onto the back porch. And I had no idea how to put a sink back in, but I had figured out how to take it off the wall. And then she kind of through squinty eyes said, good morning. And I said, good morning. And then I said, hey, look out on the porch. And she looked out on the porch and she saw this picture of Weston sitting on the toilet that he loved, being on the porch, still in his pajamas. It was still kind of the beginning of the day. And so through these kind of, half awake, sort of squinty eyes, Becca looked at me and said, I guess this is demo day for us. And that was the start of the remodeling project. And really, bless her heart in that. Because, and I don't mean that in the Southern way of blessing someone's heart and saying something bad. Bless her heart in the sense that there are a lot of things she could have said in that moment. All of them would have been justified. I thought you were downstairs until right now, honey. All of them would have been justified. And that's what she said. And through like a squinty smile, that's what she said, just kind of waking up. And that's how the project started for us. And if you know anything about the show Fixer Upper, that we've been kind of playing clips from, Demo Day is like a base part of every episode on that show. So we're going to watch a little clip of one of their Demo Days.
Do you have the guts to take on a Fixer Upper?
Can't wait to get my, my talons into this bad boy. You know, I'm going to get in here, I'm going to do some demolition, and then I'm going to do some renovation, and then I'm going to do some revelation. And then this project's going to be in the books, baby. This will be fun, baby. All right, well, I'll get to work.
Sounds good.
Now we've got a plan in place. I really feel like Joe and I are on the same page, so look out, world. I'm going to go let my hair down.
Today is demo day. It's like a dog on a leash.
Chewing on a bone. Baby, look at, I really did. I conditioned my hair today.
I know, it's...
Feel it.
Real soft. We've got an entire kitchen to gut. We've got an entire master bathroom to gut. Open up some of the case openings. Got a lot to do.
Hardwood floors. Sweet. Sometimes when you start doing the demolition process, you start uncovering some of the other things.
You think
electrical,
shiplap?
Plumbing. I don't think so in this house, but that's just.
Should we have a friendly little bet?
$5.
$5.
Okay. About to find out who wins $5 and who does. Uh-oh. I honestly didn't think this house was quite old enough. Holy moly. $5. Rascal.
$5. I'm thinking I'm gonna go buy myself a double meat, double cheese. Mm-hmm. Easy on the mayo.
That's my girl. Got the kitchen about two-thirds done. Finding a bunch of hardwood floors in places
Pretty.
We didn't know they existed.
That saves some money.
Saved us big money.
I love that.
It's
okay.
Huge.
Well, sweet.
Like, you wanna come help?
No. I gotta go spend my $5.
You know, I ripped apart a little powder room that's like 15 square feet, that was tiny, and I made a huge mess in that process, and I didn't know part of what I was doing, and there were things that played into that, but I can't imagine the mess that takes place on the show. And I know there's a dramatic effect with TV that they're smashing things with hammers that don't need to be smashed and all of that kind of process. But when you watch the show, I mean, they take these homes and they take them down to the studs. They take walls out. They're doing redoing all of the ceiling, the walls, the floors, just kind of stripping it down to the very bare bones. And then they start the process of rebuilding. But at the end of demo day, those houses are trash, you know, really mid-demo day. Those houses just look like a disaster. When you see that process, and this is why they focus on demo day, and you see the end result, I mean, it's incredible that what they're starting with and in the midst of that mess, that something good comes out of that. And the truth is that all of us outside of home projects experience those kinds of moments of demo days. And I'm not talking about the demo days where you rip out a part of your kitchen and you start working on a project and you have this hopefulness that it's going to get turned around. I'm talking about the mid-demo day kind of moment where you start tearing into something and you realize, there are other problems here that I didn't see before. Or you start tearing into something and you realize this is making a huge mess and this is not what I anticipated in the house. Or you start, you know, tearing into something and then you realize the plan I had isn't going to work and I don't see any kind of solution for what's taking place. Because those demo days, they happen as well. And lots of times, again, to move away from our physical homes, we experience demo days like that happen in the relationships that are inside of our homes. where every family goes through these periods of fighting, where all relationships in families go through these moments where it feels kind of like the house is being torn apart because of the conflict that exists inside of those families. That is a reality of the lives that we live and of the families that we have, that if you're in a family for any significant amount of time, there's going to be some fighting that takes place in that family. And some of those fights are very minor issues. You know, it is a lifelong process that kids will battle over whose job it is to do things like take out the garbage or clean up after the dog or load the dishwasher. You know, whose turn it is, who did it last. Those are things that are just going to come up. It's a lifelong battle that spouses will take on. That there's a proper way to fold laundry and an improper way. That there's a proper way to load the dishwasher and an improper way to load the dishwasher. There are all kinds of these little minor surface issue fights that take place in families and in homes. There are things that people get particular about or snippy about, and that's a part of life. But this isn't really thinking about those sorts of fights. There are also major fights that happen inside of our families. You know, and sometimes these stem from minor fights where someone will be agitated about something minor, and then all of a sudden that dumb fight over whose turn it is to clean up from the dog, it becomes, you know, insulting words that are shared, frustration that's expressed. There are moments certainly where spouses go through these difficult periods of time where it just seems like a number of issues stack up that you're not seeing eye to eye on. And all of a sudden, minor things, they sort of become more major obstacles in a marriage. There are certainly times where in the relationship between kids and parents, where there are these major fights that break out because a kid feels like a parent is kind of hindering their sense of freedom and a parent feels like a kid is disrespecting the authority that they have. Those kinds of fights, they are really significant fights. And those kind of fights, they have an impact on our homes and on our family dynamics and on the way that we live. And sometimes those fights are not very easily resolved. Sometimes those fights are very difficult things for us to deal with. You know, I know more than one family who, or more than one kid who's had their bedroom door removed after it got slammed in the face of their parent. I had a good friend of mine who, when he went through this phase early in high school, where when he would fight with his parents, he would punch a hole in his wall, and he was a big comic book fan, and then he'd put a poster over the hole in the wall. And it was years after he moved out. His parents went to repaint the room. He had kind of forgotten about it, and they found all of these holes that had been punched in his wall. So those are kind of major fights that take place inside of families, and they happen in lots of different families where things like that happen. And so even in good families, in all families, there are fights that happen. And this isn't an exhaustive list, but there are typically five different kinds of fighters that are in families. The first is this. Some people are yellers when they fight. Some people think that the louder they explain their point, the more clear it will become to the people who are around them. And even if it doesn't become more clear, they don't care because it feels good to just get it out nice and loud so that you can talk over all of the rest of the noise. Some people will just be yellers. Some people will be what I'd refer to as a debate club champion. And so if you're in this camp, it means that when you go to a fight, you maybe don't carry the same level of emotion and energy that a yeller will have, but you'll certainly come into it with a level of ration that a yeller cannot have. You'll be able to make bullet point lists. You'll be able to cite dates when things were said that shouldn't have been said. You'll be able to kind of make sure that at the end of the argument, if no one else is, that at least you are thoroughly convinced that you own no part of the blame, that you haven't done anything wrong in the situation. You justify things, and you do it to others. There's criers. Who are in arguments. This isn't like the town crier. This is like the person who can't sit in a room where an argument happens without crying. Whether they're involved or not, that level of sort of emotion is something that is overwhelming to them. It doesn't mean they don't like to fight. It doesn't mean they're not engaging in the fight. It just means they're going to be really emotional throughout the whole process of the fight. And then there's one that's kind of near and dear to me as a middle child. But there's this stereotype of middle children that they try to avoid conflict. And certainly they will oftentimes find themselves in kind of the peacemaker mode. But it doesn't mean that they actually don't like fighting. It just means, or it doesn't mean that they actually kind of see a resolution to the fight. It just means they don't like to experience it. And so they sort of try to calm and smooth over the situation as quickly as possible. And then finally, this might be the most deadly kind of fighter is the silencer. This is when you walk into a room, you know, lots of spouses have had this experience, and it's clear that their spouse is upset with them, and it's clear that they have no idea why their spouse is upset with them, and that their spouse isn't particularly interested in talking to them about it. It happens certainly with kids and parents, again, between spouses, this kind of action where someone will walk away, will go to their room, will close the door, won't want to talk about it, and it isn't that they're not fighting. It's just that they're not kind of bringing the other person into the loop to let them know. Because that person getting the silent treatment, they're definitely fighting. You know, they're trying to figure out what took place, what happened, who's responsible for what took place in the situation. So there are all kinds of different fighters. And even if you are not a yeller, even if your family doesn't yell, even if you don't do some of the stereotypical kinds of actions for fighting, at some point or another, we are all going to fight in our homes, in our relationships. And this is an interesting thing, but there's wisdom in Scripture that tells us that there's a common source for the fighting that we experience. And when you think about it, all our homes have unique things that we fight over. We all have unique ways that we carry out those fights. Parents all have unique ways that they go through the process of handling children after a fight. Spouses go through unique ways of reconciliation. There are all kinds of ways that are very unique to your own families. But Scripture tells us that there's a common source to the fighting that we have. And so as we think about that, we're going to be reading from James chapter 4 to look at this. And just to give a quick snapshot of the book of James, it's written by the brother of Jesus. And so there's family dynamics there even, that when you read through the gospel accounts, you see that early on, Jesus' family was a little bit unsure that all of the sudden, you know, his brothers were a little bit unsure that all of the sudden their brother was the Messiah. And so while there's some uncertainty initially, James becomes one of the leaders of the early church in Jerusalem. And he writes this letter to Christians, and he specifically instructs us in a piece of the letter on fighting. And so we're going to look at James chapter 4, and we're going to start reading in verse 1 to see what James says about fighting. It says, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from the shortcomings of your spouse?" Does anyone see that in their scripture? Different, no. Well, we'll try again. "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from the disobedience of your children?" Still not there. I don't think you're going to find that. "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come because of the unfair treatment that you experience in this world when you do not get what you deserve?" Our Bibles don't say any of that about what causes fights and quarrels among us. Our scripture says this in James chapter 4, verse 1. He says, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you?" When James writes about what causes fights and quarrels among us, it becomes very clear that even though in our nature we're tempted in moments of fighting to say, the reason I'm fighting is because, you know, my spouse isn't doing this, because my kids aren't doing that, because my parents are treating me like this. There are all kinds of reasons why when we start a fight, we start by pointing that finger outwardly before we would ever consider thinking about ourselves. But in James chapter 4, verse 1, he says, "What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you?" That this is how things are exercised. And what does James mean by this? How do the fights, how do they start within us? Well, it's clear in the start that we all have things that we want that we do not possess. We all have things that we want that we do not have in this life. We have desires in our heart. There are material things that we want that we do not have. Lots of us would love if we had, you know, more money, a nicer car, a nicer house, a smaller waistline, you know, nicer clothes, better friends, you know, all kinds of things that we can look through and say, I would really like if I had that. There are lots of emotional things that we want and that some of us, that we don't have. Whether you can look and say, I really wish I had a better connection with more people. I really wish that my spouse and I had a relationship that looked like this. I really wish that my kids and I or my parents and I, that we had a relationship that looked differently, that it looked like this. There are things that we want and don't have emotionally. Spiritually, there are things that we want and that we don't have. A lot of us would love to say, you know, we look at other people sometimes and we say, I would love to be able to do what they do. Or I would love to have that kind of faith, you know, as this person who's walking through a hard place doesn't seem to have any sort of wavering or questioning in their faith. I would love to have joy in the midst of despair. I'd love to have hope in the midst of situations that just seem hopeless. I would love to be kind and generous even when things feel really tight at home. There are all kinds of things where we would say, you know, I would love to live like this, but I'm not living like this. I would love to have this. But I don't have this. And James says that it's these battles that take place within us, these desires for things we want and don't have that take place within us that cause the fights that take place outside of us. He goes on to say this in verse 2. You desire, and this is the real verse 2. You desire but do not have, so you kill. You covet but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. And remember, this is a word to the church. This is James writing to Christians. And so he's saying it's in those moments where we don't get what we want that we start to point fingers at other people, that we start to blame other people. And when we think about this, there are two things. He's exaggerating when he's saying you don't get what you want, so you kill people. If he was writing that letter, it would be to someone who's in prison or was facing execution. But he's saying that when we have things that we want that we don't get, that we're willing to misuse, to mistreat, and to really lack any sort of care for other people to get what we want in life, and that causes our fights. And when we think about this, he's writing this to the early church. If you were with us over the last few months, we spent 3 months looking at the early church. And when you look at that, there's a lot less quarreling and disagreeing happening. It kind of paints this almost utopian picture in the beginning of Acts that says the church is taking care of people who they're meeting all of the needs that people have. They're sharing. They're meeting together in fellowship and breaking bread on a regular basis. I mean, it paints this kind of ideal picture of community. And it doesn't take long for James to need to address that ideal picture has kind of been shattered. It doesn't take long for James to address that even though that is still an ideal to uphold and to live out, that the reality is that there are things that we want and that we don't have, and they cause all kinds of fights and disagreements among us. And there's a Christian counselor who's written a couple of books, Dr. Emerson Eggerich, and he talks about how lots of times in these situations, what happens is that in relationships, spouses, parents, kids, siblings, that we enter into kind of this crazy cycle in relationships where what we do is we use a lot of negative reinforcement to try to force another person to do something positively. He says that too often we use negative wording in order to produce positive results in another person. We think that by tearing another person down and where they're at, that all of a sudden they'll become better, they'll do what we want them to do, they'll act in the way that we want them to act. And certainly, there's a level of this where negative reinforcement, you know, is okay. Where having expectations for someone else is okay. It's good that we have expectations for our spouses and how they will treat us and how they'll respond to us and how they'll respect us. It's good that we have expectations for our kids. It's good that kids have expectations for their parents. All of those things are good. But he says that too often we enter into this cycle where we tear each other down in an effort to kind of get what we want, in an effort to get a positive result from another person. And life just doesn't work like that. It reciprocates. That's why it becomes a cycle. We start to do that to our spouse, and then they start to do it back to us. We start to treat our kids in that way, and they start to treat each other, treat us in that way. It's a process that we need to be able to break. And we've all seen sort of this process take place in different points. I can vividly remember this moment where when I was in youth ministry, I went to one of my students' baseball games. And I was sitting there, and it was a high school baseball game. And I was sitting with a dad that deeply loved his son, that I knew he loved his son, and that he wanted the best for his son. And he also loved the game of baseball. And his son was the starting catcher on the high school baseball team. And so we sat there, and early on in the game, he was just laying into his son. He was he was right there in the stands, and he's just yelling at his son, berating him. When he would make a mistake, he's yelling at him. When he did something good, he was yelling at him. When he did something, like caught a ball and threw it back to the pitcher, he's yelling at him. He just was kind of relentless in yelling at his son, and he loved baseball and loved his son so much that in his mind, he was kind of instructing and helping his son, but it became uncomfortable to sit in the stands and to watch. It became uncomfortable to be with the dad. It became so uncomfortable for the people who were sitting there that other parents who were sitting around started cheering for his son when his dad was berating him. And you're watching the son just kind of, sulking back to the dugout, the son not looking over at the stands at all. You're watching the coach look over at the dad at points. And it became this like embarrassing, awkward moment like that, that moment that you see, with parents and youth sports gone bad and gone ugly. And after the game, the kid just kind of sulked over, didn't look at us, got in the truck, and just waited for his dad to be ready to go. And it was this moment where you saw the desires that this dad had for his son were kind of crushing him. And it wasn't really about the son. It was the desires that this dad had that forced him to use all of this negative reinforcement on his son in a way to try to help him, but it just didn't work. And James tells us that our desires, our covetousness, when we make things about ourselves or about what we can get out of a situation, that's a moment where conflict begins. When we start to tear each other down to get what we want, then that's oftentimes the source of the conflict. And so instead of pointing that finger at others, we need to oftentimes begin by thinking about ourselves and about what we want to get out of a situation. In the second half of verse 2 and into verse 3, this is the final piece of the passage we're going to read. James says this: "You do not have because you do not ask God. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures." So James wraps up this section by explaining a novel concept that when we need something, when we want something, whether it's in another person or whether it's something in life that we want, that maybe the reason why we don't have it is because we're looking to be fulfilled through other people. We're looking to get what we want through other people instead of looking to God and seeking Him out in prayer for that other person or for the things that we want to have in life. James explains to us that we don't have things because we don't ask God. And then he goes a step further and says that we continue to kind of act and live out in this selfish and kind of covetous way towards others. And that oftentimes we don't get what we ask because we only want it for our own pleasure. We only want it so that we can spend it on ourselves. We only want it to fulfill some kind of selfish desire that we have. So when we think about the demo days that take place in our homes, when we think about the fights that are inevitably going to happen, we need to remember this wording from James chapter 4. We need to remember this idea from James chapter 4 that oftentimes when fighting is occurring, it comes because there are two people that have desires for life, and that at least one of them, but probably both of them, is not having those desires met. And so I'm going to ask you to do two things when conflict comes up. The first is this: that we need to recognize that on some level, this fight is occurring because you are not getting what you want from the other person. And this is an important thing to recognize because this happens. If you can step back when a fight begins and think and ask yourself the question, what am I not getting that I want here? Then you start to own a little bit of the disagreement that's taking place. It starts to lower that temperature on the argument. And you might come back with an answer to say, you're justified. You're not getting something that you should be getting. You're not getting the level of respect or care or kindness. You know, there might be justified things that you come back with, but when you ask that question, it helps to identify what's really the source here. Why am I fighting in this way? Why am I giving someone the silent treatment? Why am I yelling right now? Why am I trying to not choke up and to start crying in the midst of this argument? When you start to ask yourself that question, you recognize what you own in the disagreement. And then this is another important question that we need to ask ourselves, or something we need to consider. We need to consider who we might be harming because we're not getting our way in life. Whether you're a kid who's here, a single parent who's here, a spouse who's here, you know, whatever situation that you're in, we need to consider who we might be harming because we're not getting our way in life. What are the expectations that we're putting on other people because we want to get something out of them? And are those selfish expectations or are they things to really help them in life? In Matthew chapter 5, verse 9, Jesus says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God." And in this passage, it doesn't mean that there's not going to be conflict. It assumes that conflict is going to exist. If it didn't, there would be no need for peacemakers and for this kind of ongoing role of being a peacemaker. But in that passage, what Jesus reveals to us is that it's not someone who kind of has the middle child syndrome or someone who tries to avoid fighting or skirts issues because they don't want to engage in fighting. But it's when we engage in fighting well. It's whenever we really get to the heart of an issue and try to bring resolution and solve a problem that's taking place. When we can look at a situation that's filled with conflict and kind of own where we bring conflict into that and the expectations that we have, what our role is, and we begin to talk about that with the person that we're fighting with, that we can work to becoming peacemakers. And there's a promise of a blessing that as we seek to be peacemakers, to put an end to the conflict that's around us, that we will be recognized, that we will be called children of God. And so this morning I would ask you to consider those points. When conflict happens, consider what you're not getting that you want, and to just think about your life and consider the expectations that you're putting on other people.